They will regulate and militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad to be with you on the program today. I'm glad you are with me as well. Hopefully you had a great weekend. Actually, it wasn't too bad. Yeah, well, I say that. I was on a lawnmower yesterday. It was a heat index of 110, which does kind of suck. But, it actually felt a little bit more bearable than it has recently. Hopefully you had a good weekend weather-wise and otherwise as well. So I was perusing the social medias this morning, and I don't post a lot, but occasionally I do lurk on X.com, and I ran across this post from Larry Keen from the National Shooting Sports Foundation. This op-ed is riddled with falsehood / misinformation, anti-gun lies, can't silence the truth, 4.5 million suppressors, still subject to the NFA and Gun Control Act, meaning two background checks to buy one. Talk about Donald Trump's one big beautiful bill removing federal tax on gun silencers. So there was a link to an op-ed at the Hill entitled "Silence Kills. Now is the time to speak up against deadly gun silencers." So I, based on Larry's high dudgeon about this op-ed, I decided to take a look. And yeah, there are a lot of problems with this, both within the op-ed itself, and I'm going to say with maybe we need a little bit of truth and labeling laws for op-eds, because according to The Hill, the author of this piece, Sally Young, a senior at Dartmouth College studying English and public policy, which is true enough. But if you go to Sally Young's LinkedIn, as it turns out, she is also a communications intern for Brady United Against Gun Violence, which I think is germane to the op-ed that she's writing. And I don't know why The Hill did not include that bit of information in its author bio, because it is fairly important, right? Sally Young has a particular point of view, and she's entitled to have that point of view, but I think the audience is also entitled to know that she is working with a major gun control group who may have even helped her craft this op-ed for The Hill. But within the op-ed itself, there are some issues here. So she talks about and starts out her piece by talking about a mass shooting in Virginia Beach back in 2019 at the City Hall complex. As she says, a gunman shot and killed 12 people at a municipal building. His semi-automatic weapon was fitted with a silencer, making the gunshot sound to one survivor, quote, like a nail gun. If the shots had been louder, if the people inside had been given even 30 more seconds of warning, lives could have been perhaps saved. But muffled sounds from the silencer created confusion and ultimately death. Now, there's a link in that quote, right, the like a nail gun. That link goes to an NBC News story where, among other things, there's also this quote. Pete Blair, executive director of the Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training at Texas State University, said it's not necessarily the specific type of weapon that matters based on data his group has collected. Quote, it's the number of weapons that people bring. Typically, in the high death events, it's multiple weapons that are brought to the scene. The Virginia Beach suspect who died at the scene in a gun battle with police carrying two 45 caliber handguns. Now, I can understand why Sally Young didn't want to include that quote, because she wants it. She wants her audience to believe that, oh my God, it was the silencer itself. That was it that led to that body count, right? By the way, the Virginia Beach municipal complex was a gun-free zone. She doesn't acknowledge that either. And there was at least one employee who, in the aftermath of this attack, had talked about the perpetrator of this attack beforehand, was raising all kinds of red flags. And in fact, she wanted to be able to bring her pistol to work with her, but wasn't able to do so because of the no guns allowed policy that the killer flagrantly violated. Right. I had no problem doing that. But there were enough red flags raised that there were other coworkers, employees who were concerned about this guy, wanted to be able to protect themselves, and were unable to do so because, well, they had to choose between bringing their gun to work and possibly being fired, or, you know, leaving their gun behind and possibly being the victim of this guy. Anyway, none of that included in Sally Young's op-ed. Nope. Instead, there was also this from the NBC News report in 2019. Nearly 1.5 million silencers were registered as of February 2018, according to the ATF. That's more than five times the approximately 285,000 silencers that the agency reported registered in December of 2010. And again, going back to Larry Keene's post on X, 4.5 million suppressors now lawfully owned. So have we seen an exponential rise in the number of crimes in which a silencer-equipped firearm is used? No, we have not. Those crimes are still exceedingly rare, something that, again, Sally Young doesn't want to talk about. In her op-ed, she writes, within President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act was a little noticed but dangerous provision eliminating the $200 federal tax requirement on firearm silencers. Now, first of all, this wasn't little noticed. There was plenty of news coverage about this, both before, in fact, throughout the negotiations, right? Because remember, this language, as it passed out of the House, was different than what the Senate Finance Committee, I believe it was. Remember, they introduced a language that would have repealed the tax and registration requirements on suppressors, short-barreled rifles, any other weapons. Senate parliamentarians said, no, you can't do that. You got to keep the registration in place. So it zeroed out the taxes on suppressors, SBRs, and short-barreled shotguns as well, and any other weapons, while keeping the registration requirements in place, right? And again, there was plenty of discussion about this along the way, certainly in 2A circles, but even some mainstream media reports included the fact that the One Big Beautiful Bill Act had this language. You also had anti-gun Democrats in Congress and outside of Congress who were screaming about this provision. So it wasn't like this was snuck in, as Sally Young claims, right? She says, sold as a win for freedom and self-defense, this repeal does nothing to make ordinary Americans safer. Instead, it makes it easier to acquire deadly tools that muffle the sound of gunfire and can make shootings harder to detect and survive. Does it make it easier? I mean, it makes it slightly more, well, $200. I mean, I don't know if that's slightly more affordable to you or significantly more affordable to you, significantly more affordable to me, but it doesn't make it any easier. As Larry Keene said, the registration requirements still exist. So while the $200 transfer tax is zeroed out, you still have to submit your NFA application. You still have to be approved. We're still talking about multiple background checks, as Larry Keene mentioned. The one thing that has changed is that it's going to be $200 cheaper to purchase a suppressor. Young says for nearly a century, silencers, also called suppressors, were subject to a $200 tax and required a federal registration process with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Well, the BATFE didn't exist 90 years ago, so that wasn't the case. But anyway, the goal wasn't to ban them outright, she says, but to treat them with caution and scrutiny. The idea was to restrict them and restrict their access as much as possible by taxing the purchase of those items. And as we've seen recently, Democrats want to raise that tax. Right, they say, well, $200 back then, I mean, that was almost $5,000 today. So why don't we have an almost $5,000 tax? So, no, it wasn't about scrutiny. It wasn't about caution. It was about artificially limiting the number of Americans who could afford to purchase one of these items. Young says, by removing the tax, the bill treats them like ordinary firearm accessories. With the federal tax removed, the financial and procedural barriers that once slowed down silencer purchases are gone, making it easier and potentially faster to obtain them. In effect, this policy turns silencers into impulse buys available with minimum oversight, even in states with already loose gun laws, which is, again, flat out wrong. You still have to register these items. You still have to, again, go through the NFA process to obtain one of these items. If the registration requirement had been knocked down as well as we hoped it would be, then Young's argument might be correct, right? It would be treated the same as purchasing a firearm because they would still be considered firearms under the Gun Control Act. So you would still have to go through a NICS check in order to purchase a suppressor. If you lived in a state with a waiting period but allowed the purchase of suppressors, you still have to, you know, wait your 10 days or 7 days or however long. And of course, if you lived in a state where suppressors are banned, you wouldn't be able to buy them any more than you're able to legally possess them now. But no, this doesn't speed up the process. This doesn't reduce the number of background checks. It certainly doesn't mean that suppressors are now going to be treated as any other firearm, because the registration requirement is still in place. Now, either Sally Young knows this and wants to mislead her readers, or her months spent as a communications intern at Brady have taught her nothing about how to read a piece of legislation, or frankly, news stories. And honestly, this is one of those falsehoods that should have been caught by the editors at The Hill. Whoever looked at this op-ed and ran with it did not do their due diligence in determining whether or not what Sally Young wrote in an opinion piece was factually correct. Now, she's allowed to have her opinion. She is not allowed to make up facts. Her op-ed continues, proponents of silencer deregulation argue that suppressors reduce hearing damage for recreational shooters and make gun ranges less disruptive to neighbors, which is true. They frame the tax and registration process as bureaucratic overreach that burdens lawful gun owners, which is also true. But these talking points, she writes, ignore the ultimate threat to public safety that silencers carry. People have and will continue to die because of easy access to silencers. I thought we didn't have easy access to silencers. She just was complaining that it's become easier because supposedly the scrutiny and caution is gone, even though that's not the case. And again, I'm confused. What was it difficult to get silencers before and now it's not? Was it easy to get silencers before and now it's even easier? I don't understand. She writes, further, with the removal of federal tax on silencers, the gun lobby is better equipped to argue in court against any and all government regulation of silencers. Well, that is probably true, except they're not arguing against any and all regulation of suppressors. The laws that are challenging state-level bans on suppressors, for example, like the ones that have been filed in New Jersey recently, don't argue that suppressors should be treated as simply accessories. Right, in which no background check is required, although that is the case in many European countries. And arguably, a suppressor is an accessory far more than it is an actual firearm, right? But right now, essentially, the legal argument is, let's treat them like firearms. Let's treat them like they're not restricted items. And yes, zeroing out the tax does help aid that argument. But again, 4.5 million suppressors legally in the hands of Americans, and they are not commonly used in crime. They are commonly used for lawful purposes, like protecting your hearing at the range, making the sound of your shooting less intrusive to your neighbors. Young says, even if silencers have some legitimate uses, removing the federal tax and treating them like common firearm accessories opens the door to widespread abuse. Again, that's not what is happening here. Responsible gun owners, she says, can still protect their hearing with earmuffs. Communities can't protect themselves from gunfire they never hear coming. Well, again, I mean, listen, arguably, I mean, if that's the argument, right, why not just call for an outright ban on handguns? Because clearly, given the use of handguns in violent crime, communities can't protect themselves against the sound of gunshots that they can hear. Plus, we know, again, that suppressors don't make the sound of gunshots noiseless, right? They reduce the decibel level of gunfire by anywhere from 20 to 40 decibels, bringing it down from like the sound of a jet engine to the sound of a jackhammer. That's not noiseless. Right? That's not silence. Silencer is actually a misnomer because it doesn't silence the sound of a gunshot. Now, it's true. You know, gun owners can wear earmuffs. I do tend to wear earmuffs. I don't like the little... I probably should just go ahead and get like the custom made, but I don't. So I use some cans usually. But that has nothing for my neighbors. Does nothing for my dog, who freaks out at the noise of thunder, fireworks, and yes, gunshots. When we're out walking on the property, if any of my neighbors are shooting, I mean, she freaks out. She panics. If my neighbors were using suppressed firearms, she might still honestly freak out by that because she would probably still be able to hear it. But she doesn't generally, I don't know. It's an open question. And certainly for gun owners, there is a legitimate benefit to being able to use, let's say you use earmuffs with a suppressed firearm. That's even better. I don't see what the objection is here. I just think that it's baseless. And again, you can't ask your neighbors, hey, I'm going to be shooting here, so can you just put your earmuffs on for the next hour or two or four or five? It's just not practical. It's not feasible. Young says, in conclusion, the repeal didn't happen by accident. It slipped through quietly. No, it did not. Buried in a massive bill. It was a massive bill. With little debate and even less public awareness. Again, not true. But that doesn't mean the story ends here, she says. Well, that much is true. What happens when silencers become easier to buy than ever before? Well, not ever before, because remember, before the National Firearms Act, suppressors were not restricted items. So, it used to be far easier than it will be under the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Anyway, what role can we play, she says, in making sure our communities stay safe and our voices stay heard? Oh, so our communities are safe. So I guess it was harder. It wasn't easy to get them, even though she says it was easy to get them. I'm confused. And, of course, her response is basically, you know, join the gun control lobby. Write and call your senators. No mention, again, of the fact that she is a communications intern for Brady. So, yeah, I mean, Larry King was right. That op-ed piece was rife with misinformation and outright falsehoods. In advance of an anti-gun agenda. The truth is that suppressors are rarely used in crime. That has been the case when there were a couple of 100,000 registered suppressors. That continues to be the case when there are several million registered suppressors. And by the way, it is also possible, as I'm sure you know, to make a suppressor yourself. Now, you'll be violating federal law, right? But it's easy to do. And even with that ease, we rarely see suppressors used in crime, either those legally possessed or those illegally possessed and produced. It's just not an issue. Now, we are talking about something that I believe is protected by the Second Amendment, something that, frankly, I do believe is a firearm accessory, not a firearm itself. Like probably you, and I know like many gun owners, I was disappointed that the ultimate language of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act did not also zero out the registration requirements for suppressors, short-barreled firearms, and any other weapons. And I am hopeful that litigation will undo those restrictions. But it is simply not true that zeroing out the $200 stamp tax on these items is going to make it easier to purchase them, will reduce the number of background checks in order to purchase them, or remove them from the NFA entirely. None of those things are true. It will simply make it a more affordable option for Americans to take a reasonable step to lower, but not eliminate, the noise that their firearms produce when the trigger is pulled and it goes bang. That's it. And there is no reason to freak out. Other than, again, outright and innate hostility to our right to keep and bear arms itself. All right. Let's move on to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, because it is starting to heat up here in the studio, and you don't want to see me sweating like a pig. Speaking of sweating, though, Juanita Holmes, who is heading up NYC's probation department, she should be sweating a little bit here. The headline from the city, a hot mess, chaos engulfs probation department under Juanita Holmes. And this is pretty interesting. You know, typically when we talk about our recidivist report, we're talking about a specific story, a specific incident. The city, I believe it's the city.org is the website. They're reporting on what's going on with the probation department in New York City in general. They say as of June the 1st, the probation department, operating with just 750 staff members, despite having 974 budgeted positions. So about a quarter of the positions there, the probation department, are vacant right now. Meanwhile, they say probation violations are on a sharp rise. Even as city officials are touting a decline in violent crime, the lowest number of shooting incidents ever recorded the first 6 months of this year, according to officials. Councilmember Sandy Nurse, a Democrat from Brooklyn who chairs the City Council's Committee on Criminal Justice, told the city the agency is a hot mess. People are leaving in droves. The programs are being chopped without explanation. Technical violations are spiking, and frontline workers are being pushed to the brink. The Department of Probation, according to a May 2024 report by the state comptroller, has the highest employee attrition rate of any city agency, with a turnover spike of 128.6% above pre-pandemic levels, which is nearly double the next highest agency. The city reports that the decrease in officers, largely due to staff fleeing for higher-paying jobs in nearby counties. The president of the United Probation Officers Association, Dalvaney Powell, told the city probation officers are proud public servants who play a vital role in keeping our community safe and helping individuals get back on the right path. But ongoing staffing challenges are making that mission harder. Indeed, it appears so. The city reports that morale has plummeted across the board, in part due to Juanita Holmes' controversial requirement that all probation officers carry firearms regardless of assignment. Now, here's the thing. That would be controversial to most of us, right? The problem, though, is that some officers say they feel undertrained in firearm use. So they're basically told, hey, you got to carry a gun. And they're like, I don't feel comfortable carrying one. Right? I don't necessarily have a problem with the requirement that probation officers be armed for their own protection, if nothing else. But if you're going to require that, again, shouldn't you make sure that these officers are comfortable doing so, that they feel like they've been adequately trained to do so, particularly given the training requirements for people who are probation officers who want to carry a firearm for self-defense, right? Anyway, it is a huge problem, the probation department in New York City. Today, the city council plans to hold a hearing to grill Holmes about the broader issues facing the department, according to the city. And we'll see what happens. I mean, if there's a spike in recidivism, there is a huge gap in the number of budgeted positions and the number of frontline probation officers, that's a big problem. And it appears to be one of, if not design, one that could be and should be addressed. Now, on to today's Armed Citizen story. I'm pretty sure you know what we're going to be talking about, right? This mass stabbing in Michigan over the weekend that was, if not stopped, at least... I say it not stop because apparently the guy had stopped actively stabbing people when he was confronted by the armed citizen. But at the very least, the armed citizen was able to detain that attacker, hold him until the police arrived, ensure that he didn't drive off somewhere else and commit another stabbing at another location. The New York Post, armed hero Marine veteran Derek Perry, praised for confronting Michigan Walmart mass stabbing suspect in dramatic showdown. And again, he did not confront the attacker while he was actively stabbing somebody inside that Walmart. Okay, let's make that clear. Still, Perry confronted the guy in the parking lot, yelling at him to drop the knife, and again, holding him there at gunpoint until police showed up to take him into custody. Perry's daughter talking on social media, on Facebook, saying that his heroism is a proud daughter moment. His daughter-in-law said that the veteran is a true hero. And I absolutely believe that that is the case. His actions, by the way, in the presence of his firearm may have actually helped others feel more confident in helping to keep this guy at bay and there on the scene until authorities arrived. Sunday, police identified the suspect as 42-year-old Bradford James Gilley. And again, I'm glad to know that Mr. Perry was there and had the ability to prevent this attacker from, again, stabbing anybody else and leaving the scene, which could have made it, you know, very difficult for law enforcement to find him. And again, he very well could have gone to another location and carried out another attack. But in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, Derek Perry there in Traverse City, Michigan. Also in the right place at the right time and willing to do the right thing, a good Samaritan in Prescott, Wisconsin, who helped to mitigate the damage of a boat that was on fire that ultimately exploded. According to the Prescott police chief, they're not sure how the explosion and fire began, but nobody was hurt, thankfully. Authorities aren't sure how many people were on board the boat at the time, but by the time it exploded, there were people who had already gotten off the boat. There were some who were kind of ejected into the river, some folks taken to the local hospital. But again, nobody was killed, and it sounds like nobody was really even critically injured at this point. A lot of the eyewitnesses, according to Fox 9 in, I believe this is Minneapolis, say that there was a good Samaritan named Colton Anderson who helped keep the fire spreading to other docks and other boats. He saw the boat burning, and I guess he was on shore, so he jumped into his boat, made his way to the boat that was on fire. According to the police chief, he tied up the boat, trimmed her up, sprayed the boat down with water, not with a hose, but basically with a rooster tail on the prop, basically, you know, using the water from the lake to hit the boat. He said, the chief said that diminished the flames enough, put the flames out on the dock. So apparently the dock was on fire. And then he was able to push the boat out from the dock and away from another boat that was in danger of catching on fire. Anderson tells Fox 9 that he kept the fire under control until first responders were able to put it out. And again, I mean, this is, you know, it's a scary situation enough. And there were people who were injured, but this could have been far worse were it not for the case of Colton Anderson. Again, being in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing to help those strangers in need there in Prescott, Wisconsin. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program. As always, thank you. Love having you here. Looking forward to doing this again tomorrow. Not sure who we'll be talking to. I've got a couple of feelers out. I know that the Wednesday morning we are scheduled to speak with the Bearing Arms contributor, John Petrolino. I'm looking forward to doing that. It's been a while since we've had John on the program, and he's been doing some great reporting here at Bearing Arms. In fact, he's got a story that went up midday afternoon, probably already posted by the time you see this, regarding a civil lawsuit in the state of New Jersey filed by the Attorney General, one that essentially tries to put new gun control laws in place without any new laws being on the books. So I would encourage you to check that out. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, have a great rest of your Monday. Be well. Be safe. can be free.